There are words we say, words we're not supposed to say, and words we could say yesterday but are no longer okay today. From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, today is Friday, May 14th, and this is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, linguist John McWhorter talks about his new book, Nine Nasty Words. We explore the history of swearing, cursing, and slurs, and we do it all without uttering a bad word. Lee Strubinger reports on efforts to collect more money from people who power their homes with solar panels. Maestro Delta David Geyer talks with pianist Emmanuel Ax about how an orchestra can transform a community. Plus, the public domain tune band helps Gayville Hall celebrate 20 years. That's later in the hour. I'm Kara Hetland in for Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. First, the news.
With SDPB News, I'm Megan Feary. The state's first and only birth center is now open in Rapid City. It offers resources and care for women through all stages of pregnancy, including postpartum care. The goal of the new center is to offer women and families more options when it comes to giving birth. Co-owner Cassie Applegate is a certified nurse and midwife. She says they'll respect and honor all patients.
And I think the birth center environment does allow for freedom of how they want to give birth, freedom of who's present at their birth. And I think that most families do want a little bit more autonomy in that. And I think the birth center does provide that.
Applegate says the safest place to give birth is at a hospital or accredited birth center.
Birth centers have outstanding outcomes as far as client satisfaction, reduced cesarean sections, higher breastfeeding rates. Especially in this area, we felt like that was a service that we could offer and provide to our community.
The infant mortality rate for South Dakota was 6.7 per 1,000 births in 2019. But for Native women, that number jumps to 8.9.
Specifically for Native American women, the rate of maternal mortality and infant mortality is atrocious in our state, and it really does point to nothing other than racism in healthcare. So I think where we could help change that is to provide high quality care for all women.
Contributing factors for medical complications include tobacco use, alcohol, lack of access to health services, and inadequate medical care. However, the majority of deaths for all infants are sleep related, such as infants sleeping in an adult bed. Applegate says she hopes the new Rapid City facility will inspire other birth centers in the state. And that story was produced with assistance from Lee Strubinger. The number of South Dakotans on unemployment has dropped to pre-pandemic levels. The State Department of Labor says about 2,500 people are receiving unemployment benefits. 1 year ago, more than 25,000 South Dakotans were on unemployment. The state and federal government have paid South Dakotans $377 million in unemployment benefits since the pandemic began. South Dakota recently stopped taking federal unemployment assistance. That means unemployment payments are returning to normal, pre-pandemic levels. A South Dakota-based company has been chosen to provide daily meals to inmates at a Mississippi jail. WDAM-TV reports Covington County supervisors voted this week to award a contract to Summit Jail Food Service of Sioux Falls to handle food service at the county jail. Only two companies bid to provide meal service at the jail, and Sheriff Daryl Perkins said the offer from Summit Jail Food Service was the lowest of the two. The company plans to start its meal service on June 1st. Mostly cloudy skies tonight in the west and eastern parts of the state. It'll be windy in the west with lows in the mid to upper 40s, mostly clear in central South Dakota with lows in the mid 40s. Tomorrow there'll be showers and thunderstorms in the west with highs reaching the upper 60s. It'll be sunny in the central and eastern parts of the state with highs reaching the mid 70s. With SDPB News, I'm Megan Feary.
And I'm Kara Hetland. A 2019 presidential executive order formed the Task Force on Missing and Murdered American Indians and Alaska Natives. Flandreau Santee Sioux tribal member Jeannie Hovland served on that presidential task force, which is known as Operation Lady Justice. Hovland is now serving a term as Associate Commissioner for the National Indian Gaming Commission. Jeannie, welcome, and thanks for being on In the Moment.
Wonderful. Thank you. I'm so glad to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
So we're going to talk a little bit about your current role, but first, let's talk a little bit about the White House Task Force on Missing and Murdered American Indians and Alaska Natives that you served on. Can you tell me a little bit about your scope of your work there?
Sure, absolutely. And thank you for doing a series on this very important issue. As you talked about, Operation Lady Justice was the name of this task force. It was, or it is, a federal task force, and it consists of the Department of Interior, the Department of Justice, and the Department of Health and Human Services. It was established by President Trump through an executive order back in November of 2019. I was honored to be designated as a task force member to represent the Department of Health and Human Services because at the time I was commissioner of the Administration for Native Americans, and which by statute designated me as a commissioner to be the chair of the secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services Interdepartmental Council on Native American Affairs, which is comprised of all HHS leadership, including important programs that are in our tribal communities, such as the Indian Health Service, Center for Disease Control, SAMHSA, or Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services, HRSA, the Administration for Community Living, Administration for Children and Families, I mean, all of HHS. So I was honored to be there to represent the Department of Health and Human Services. And one of our functions at the Department of Health and Human Services was to fulfill the task force executing an education and outreach campaign for communities that are most affected by crime against Native Americans. So I had already spent a lot of my time as commissioner doing consultation that first year I was there, as confirmed by the Senate in June of 2018. And our tribes had been asking that Department of Health and Human Services be part of the efforts to combat this crisis of our missing and murdered Indigenous peoples. They wanted HHS to address issues that could prevent more of our people from going missing or being murdered. They wanted us to help individuals and families in need of intervention that are in crisis. And they also asked that HHS provide support for families and communities that are affected by this crisis and in need of healing. And it happened to be that while I was chair of the Interdepartmental Council and commissioner, this was a dual role where I was also the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Native American Affairs at the Administration for Children and Families. Now, ACF, I'll refer to it as, is the human services side of the Department of Health and Human Services. So I want to work with the ACF leadership, with our tribal leaders through consultation, through meetings with tribal members, tribal program directors, and we also had a tribal advisory committee. And through that, we developed the ACF Missing and Murdered Native Americans Framework, a public health call for action, which was made available in November of 2020. So what's unique about this is primarily when there has been a little bit of response to this crisis, it's primarily had been through investigations, through law enforcement, which is very important. But this was the first time that there was a health and human services component added to this strategy. So I'm very proud about this and want to give the credit really to the tribal leaders that asked for this, that helped formulate it, helped us to put it together. And now I believe they're in the implementation stages.
And so these are some of the successes that you have. And so really what I know you're no longer part of this task force with the new administration, but what do you see the most important work that has yet to be done?
Successes. First of all, I want to say that successes is that one of the biggest successes is that the voices of our people are finally being heard and there's action, not only being heard, but action has been taken from the White House through federal agencies. Federal agencies are collaborating now and speaking to one another, and the general public and media, like your program, are hearing about this and helping to get the word out. So I thank you so much for that. Some other successes would be the framework that I talked about, as well as the Department of Interior opened cold case offices, 7 of them across the nation. And that is something that our tribal members have been asking for a long time.
And so now you're serving a 3-year term as Associate Commissioner for National Indian Gaming Commission. So how can your current role help support economic development for tribal communities in South Dakota?
Well, thank you. I am now commissioner at the National Indian Gaming Commission, which is comprised of 3 commissioners, and we regulate and oversee our tribal gaming facilities. And, you know, economic development is very important. And the work that NIGC does is sound regulation, which is vital to ensure sustainable economic growth. And I believe another important part of my role, sorry about that, is to shed light to the positive impact that tribal gaming industry has had for our tribal communities, often including the surrounding communities that aren't on the reservations. And I think with the pandemic, it has revealed to the nation how underserved our tribal communities have been for decades, and also the health and economic disparities that we face as Native people. And quite honestly, it's often the casino revenues that supplement our social, health, and economic programs to try to meet the needs of our people, where the federal fundings have fallen short. So I think my role will also be to just talk about the positive impact that tribal gaming has had, not only in South Dakota, but for all of our tribal nations that have casinos and gaming operations.
Jeannie Hevlin, I want to thank you. I know our time scheduled was short, and I look forward to having you back on and talk more about economic development amongst the tribes in South Dakota. So thank you so much for joining us on In the Moment today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much. I appreciate this opportunity.
And you can find all of our Spotlight coverage online at sdpb.org/spotlight. You're listening to listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
This evening on Jazz Nightly, we'll hear new music from a couple of experimental groups out of Canada, the Code Quartet and Toontown. Also on the program, the Stephen Fifke Big Band featuring vocalist Veronica Swift. Plus, we'll remember Chicago pianist and arranger Norman Simmons, who worked with Ramsey Lewis, Joe Williams, Johnny Griffin, and others. I'm Carl Gerke, and you can join me at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on SDPB Radio.
Program funding is provided by First Dakota National Bank. Every big endeavor begins somewhere, with someone who has a dream and the passion to make it happen first. FirstDakota.com/first.
Hey, South Dakota, I'm Larry Gross, host of Mountain Stage, and we're proud to be on SDPB Radio Saturdays at 6 p.m. Central, 5 Mountain, and Sundays, noon Central, 11 Mountain. Each week, we feature performances from seasoned legends and emerging stars from across the USA and around the world, recorded in front of a live audience. If you agree that the world turns around a song, give us a listen. Saturdays and Sundays on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Program funding with your support and by Gene Hufford of American Family Insurance on Jackson Boulevard in Rapid City. Gene and his team working together to serve your needs. Gene Hufford Agency Incorporated. GeneHufford.com.
Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Kara Hetland in today for Lori Walsh. Black Hills Energy wants a new tariff that would charge customers with solar panels the true cost of their energy. The utility says people who generate their own electricity cost the rest of the customers more money. Some worry the proposal before the Public Utilities Commission will kill incentives to install solar systems. SDPB's Lee Strubinger has more.
Mount Rushmore National Memorial has some obvious offerings, and one that's hidden in plain sight. It's called the Thomas Jefferson Solar Canopy and features 975 panels that generate electricity equivalent to the average annual consumption of 40 American homes. The solar panels are part of a roof over one of the 2 parking garages at the memorial. In addition to generating power, the coverings protect cars from hail damage that can come when a storm rolls through.
It's protecting the vehicles underneath it, and people especially enjoy that about it in the summertime, and it provides more shade for the vehicles as well. So it's a really popular place to park under the solar array.
That's Kevin Crosby, the sustainability manager for Zanterra Travel Collection. It operates the concessions at Mount Rushmore. The company collaborated with the Park Service to install the solar system. The array powers the refrigerators that keep Thomas Jefferson's famous vanilla ice cream cool.
It provides over half of the power to our concession buildings here at Mount Rushmore, and we save in a typical year about $40,000 in electricity bills just from the solar array. So it definitely has a payback, but the main justification for it was the greenhouse gas reductions.
However, a proposal by Black Hills Energy could wipe out the cost savings Zanterra gets from solar. The company wants the Public Utility Commission to approve a new tariff on those generating some of their own power. The tariff would charge those customers market rate for the solar energy they generate. The utility would buy excess energy for about 25% of its market price. Mark Ayer is the vice president of operations for Black Hills Energy. He says the utility provider is committed to renewables.
This isn't intended to be an attack on renewables. This is really addressing an issue that that we've started to see and believe it's in best interest of all of our customers to keep rates low, especially for those that are on fixed or low income.
Utility companies like Black Hills Energy, which serves 8 states, have 2 primary costs: energy generation and infrastructure costs. The fixed infrastructure costs do not change even when consumer demand does. It's the cost of energy generation that can change. South Dakota is one of 7 states that do not use a billing technique called net metering. That system credits energy creators for the electricity they add to the grid. That practice reduces a utility's cash flow. Ayer says the goal of the tariff is not to discourage solar, but to make sure those customers are paying their fair share of fixed costs.
We have to be able to provide that service to them. So even though they are producing at times due to the intermittent nature of that service, at times they're not, and they're calling on our system to provide that service. And so there's costs associated with providing that.
The logic of that argument is lost to some.
It's similar to you and your family build a garden.
Jared Kapp and Rachel Headley live in Spearfish and specialize in sustainable design and construction. They're one of 84 Black Hills Energy customers in South Dakota that use solar to power their homes.
Build the fence and build the raised beds and run the water lines and plant the seeds, and then the grocery store is going to charge you for every pound of food that you produce out of your garden. So it makes no sense.
The couple owns a company called Cobblestone. They have a net zero commercial office building under construction in Spearfish. If the tariff passes, Rachel Headley says the project is in jeopardy. They won't be able to afford putting solar on the building and won't meet the sustainability requirements that are part of their permit with the city.
People want to be more environmental. They want to use more renewables, less non-renewables. We have people that want to be more independent from the grid. We saw what happened when the grid failed in Texas.
Much of their neighborhood lost power during a major storm back in 2013. But Kapp and Headley helped power their neighbors by lending their generator to power phones and plug-in refrigerators. Climate change is likely to create even more extreme weather systems as temperatures rise. Lee DeLang is the chief operations officer for Genpro, a national solar energy equipment supplier headquartered in Piedmont. The company works on projects from utility scale to residential, from the East Coast down to Arizona. DeLang says he understands a utility company's perspective, but he says corporations looking to move to South Dakota might have some strict renewable energy standards. He says the Public Utility Commission needs to consider what the market wants, even if it's more renewables at a slightly higher cost.
Can we in some way partner with the utility to, create some a little better scenarios than the one proposed that allow people to adopt that systems behind the meter as well.
South Dakota ranks 2nd to last in the country for solar capacity. DeLang worries this proposal could make that ranking even worse. However, he says he's glad there's debate on the issue.
If this tariff is passed, it's going to set a precedence for other investor-owned utilities as well as co-ops that might steer the ship in the wrong direction ultimately. So I think let's dial it back a little bit and let's talk about some other reasonable ways that we can approach this.
It could take months before the Public Utilities Commission rules on the tariff proposal. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Lee Strupinger in Rapid City.
You can find all of our news stories online at sdpb.org/news. Ahead on the program, what's your favorite swear word? Well, we explore the history of those words that exist, but we're not supposed to say. You're in the moment on listener-supported SDPB Radio.
Court ruling could mean families behind on rent during the pandemic will face eviction.
The most outrageous and overlooked aspect of this crisis is that we are evicting children. We are permanently altering their life course for the worse, and we are exposing them to an entirely preventable trauma.
Also, the latest on the escalating Israeli-Palestinian conflict. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Listen, beginning at 3 Central, 2 Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding by TSP. Clients get the most from their facility with the collaborative design team at TSP. Architecture, engineering, interior design, and planning. Making your space and our communities better by design. More at teamtsp.com.
Retailers are banking on consumers coming back, especially businesses in tourist towns that live or die by foot traffic.
It's actually in a preserved fishing village, very much a seasonal location.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, a stationery store in northern Michigan gearing up for a comeback. We'll tell you that story next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6:30 Central, 5:30 Mountain on SDPB Radio.
Program funding by BankWest, a full-service community bank, helping you make the most of your time and money and being there how, when, and where you want to bank. BankWest, convenient, connected, committed. Member FDIC.
Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Kara Hetland. The way we use language changes. Curse words from before the Reformation might seem quaint now. On the other hand, there are slurs we are told to never speak out loud. A new book explores how words become profanity. The book is called 9 Nasty Words, English in the Gutter, Then, Now, and Forever. The author is linguist and cultural critic John McWhorter, and Lori Walsh spoke with him yesterday.
So this book, 9 Nasty Words, is really about language from a linguist perspective, and there's a distinction for what this book is trying to do because of that. Tell us a little bit about how you put this book together from that perspective.
Well, this book is really meant to be just a fizzy good time. It's about, you know, the bad words that we are not supposed to use, but that we do use, and how they got that way, what their history is. And the thing is, nowadays our profanity is not only the words about God and words about the body, but in terms of what an anthropologist would note, profanity is also what used to be called slurs. These days, the way we process things like the N-word or a word that begins with C that I'm not going to say that can be used to refer disparagingly to women, those words are profanity in the same way as the F-word is or that damn and hell are. So I thought there needs to be a book that examines the progression from, oh my God, to the words I can't say about the body, to the N-word, et cetera, because it's part of the history of the English language. And what you see is that language always has profanity. The question is just what the profanity is about, what words are used for it. And that is something that charts with what the society is hung up on. And in a way, our profanity today being about respecting groups that, or words that disrespect groups, that is a moral and intellectual development over being hung up on, you know, what comes out of your body and, depending on your perspective, over how you refer to God and Jesus. But it's all a very interesting development, and frankly, a lot of it is very funny. Mm. I think I enjoy profanity, and I think it's a lot of fun. So I just wanted to share something as a linguist that would keep people reading and maybe get some stealth linguistics in the process. And as it happened, I didn't know the book was going to come out during what's being called our racial reckoning. But that means that the N-word chapter, I think, has a significance that I did not know it was going to have when I wrote the book a year and a half ago. And so it's just, it's an interesting package, I hope.
And you're looking for evidence of the way we use these words in different places, from popular television, you know, to things that are found in writing, to how we use words in our everyday lives. Tell us a little bit about that, the detective work that goes into this. And it is really fun and lighthearted and laugh out loud funny. But there's a lot of scholarship and, you know, behind it. Where do you go looking for how those words have evolved in their uses?
Well, a lot of these words really did start somewhere very different from where they ended up. And really, most of the work has been done. And so what I'm trying to do is share it with the public and put it in a way that a normal person who isn't sick like a linguist will actually be able to enjoy. Mm-hmm. But a lot of it is in sources like the Grand Old Oxford English Dictionary, which traces the English language about as far back as you can go in writing. And you can just see the meanings of the word changing in text over time. And then there's the other things that you learn from just reading various things and seeing how words are used in different contexts. Some of the work remains to be done. The computer corpora and the fact that the internet allows you to catch things that you wouldn't have caught, say, even as recently as 20 years ago so easily. But basically, a word starts often meaning something quite different. And so the word F, it refers to gay men, starts out meaning a bundle of sticks. And then step by step, it comes to be a slur referring to a very specific kind of human being. It's an interesting process to see. Or the word that begins with S that refers to excrement. That starts as a word meaning roughly to slice in Ukraine. And I'm not going to talk about what slicing has to do with that word because we'll just have to fill it in ourselves. But that's where it starts. And that slicing word also is the word that we use, is the root that came into the word for science. Science is about splitting things apart. It's about distinguishing. And so you have this skit part. We get that through Latin. That skit became shit. I didn't say anything. And that is why the word actually traces to the same root as science. So there are all sorts of little stories like that that you would never know, including, you know, you think about the fact that we erupt with the word, but it has a very interesting history often.
Yeah. All right. So any person who's ever been in childbirth or broken a bone or stubbed a toe knows that sometimes these words just erupt from us versus more thoughtful usage. They're activating different parts of the brain. Tell us a little bit about how the brain kind of needs swear words in some ways.
Well, what's interesting is that what starts as a word migrates over to the right side of the brain. The left side of the brain is where most people process language in terms of putting neutral sentences together. The right side of the brain, which is associated more with creativity, with, you know, the Dionysian, that side of the brain is the one that processes, for example, intonation and intent. Curses come from the right side of the brain. And so what it means is that they start as words, but what they are is eruptions, as you said. They are gestures that are in the form of words. And that's part of why often profanity as we use it doesn't make sense. If you say, "What the F is this?" how would you parse the F as a part of speech? What does the F even mean as opposed to its basic dictionary meaning? How did that get into that sentence? And it's because it isn't a word. It is a decoration upon a normal sequence of words put together with grammar. So profanity seems like it's these words that you're not allowed to use, but that's just it. They're not words anymore. They are transgressive gestures in the form of words.
And they can be rebellious. They can be joyfully nonsensical. And I'm not revealing anything about having a child, but they can be really creative when things come out of your mouth that you didn't expect.
I can imagine.
There is a great absurdity to all of this and the fact that these words exist, but we're not allowed to use them. And a word that is perfectly fine for one generation becomes taboo for the next, or vice versa. How hard is it for people to sort of keep pace with language as it changes in this connected world that we live in?
Well, that's just it, in that our classification of these things tends to lag behind how we're actually using them. And so, for example, these days, it's easy to be baffled that people have gotten so sensitive about the N-word. Much easier to understand it when you realize that the domain of profanity has changed, and now the N-word is profane the way hell or that slicing word I just talked about used to be. And so it's challenging because, for example, people have gotten sanctioned for using the F word that refers to gay men in a casual way, and wondering, you know, how, why was the floor pulled out from under them suddenly? And it was because that word has become a profanity as opposed to salty. So Eddie Murphy can use that word in jolly fashion in Raw in the late 80s. And that was considered, you know, salty and pushing it, but he could do it. The equivalent comedian could never use that word that freely today in something that was going to be viewed on Netflix by everybody. And that's because the word is now profane. So if you think of it with that kind of categorization, all of this makes more sense. If you just think of those words as still being just slurs, you think, well, people are getting so sensitive about slurs. That's missing that what's happening is that the words have come into a completely different category.
It, you know, as I was reading the N-word chapter that you mentioned, I found myself, because you do spell out the word and explain why and when you're going to use it. And my first response, you talk about being sensitive, was involuntarily I closed my eyes when I came up upon that word because I was so afraid it was going to burn itself in my brain. I didn't want to say it in my brain lest it come out of my mouth. But I'm really fascinated by this idea that there are words that we are watching transition as we live our lives. And the Washington football team, not in your book, but I'm guessing it's interesting to watch how one day all these people wore a sweatshirt with a name on it, and the next day it slowly starts to evolve into something that we refer to as a euphemism. What's happening? What are we living through as that language changes for something like the Washington football team?
Yeah, that was a beautiful example. I don't discuss it in the book, but a beautiful example of how slurs against groups are now something that we consider really evil as opposed to just jolly. And so with that particular controversy, what was interesting is that if you surveyed Native Americans, many Native Americans didn't mind that term at first. Then as time went by, more Native Americans were offended by it as a whole different dialogue started to come in. And so, yeah, that baffled many people. Everybody thought that was just fine. You think of little boys in the 50s running around with feathers on their head and using those terms, and you figure, well, what was wrong with it? And I think most of us now, kind of standing on the other side of it, can see how maybe a conversation needed to be had about it. There were people who were offended that there's, you know, something kind of tacky about this fetishization, this cartoonization of a group of dignified people. That was very 21st century. That was us witnessing profanity in transition.
And progress. Moral progress?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it is. Although I also think that it can be overdone. Mm-hmm. I genuinely think that, like, for example, you're seeing my spelling out that word on the page where I took the liberty because I'm black myself and I just couldn't imagine writing the N-word 150 times. Mm-hmm. That reaction that you had, I completely understand it. But to me, I almost wish that we had not gotten that sensitive about it because I'm thinking, it doesn't hurt me to have the word referred to. And, you know, 30 years ago, that was not considered a problem. And 30 years ago, everything was in color. There was electricity. There were computers. We felt like we were living at the end of time, just like we do now. And yet you could refer to, you know, you could use the N-word in reference in a way that now is considered unthinkable. I think the pendulum has swung a little further than I think black people need, or at least this black people. But then again, that's how things go. And I think maybe it'll swing back to the middle after another generation.
Yeah, I think that's one of the powerful things about this book is it's delightful and funny. And then something like that will happen to the reader and they'll realize that there's more going on than they really thought about before.
Everything isn't funny.
Yeah,
exactly.
Exactly. Yeah. I also want to talk about other things that are changing, including how we refer to transgender people. And I bring this up because, again, you're a linguist. This isn't necessarily in your book, although it's alluded to in different places with the LGBTQ community. NPR sent out guidelines for, you know, how to refer to transgender people and what not to, you know, what words not to use. And I found, again, that moment of absurdity and clarity as they clarified, you know, what our standards are, but also the absurdity of sending me an email with a list of words that I shouldn't say, some of which I was like, what? Who says that? So, and it goes, right. It goes back to the Washington football team, because I think in South Dakota, a lot of people would say that word was always offensive to them. It was offensive to them as children. They saw the racism growing up. How often are the people who are you know, referred to in these words, the people who drive the conversation about language, and how often does it come from other places like, you know, academia?
Mm-hmm. Well, ideally, it comes from the people themselves, making society aware of something that is offensive to them, and then society listens and changes its behavior. It's gotten to the point where white society, if we want to call it that, is often almost ahead of the curve and is aware of something being possibly offensive and takes care of itself. And by white society here, I mean roughly academia and the media. And that's a major advance. That's, I think, unprecedented in human affairs, in the whole history of a species, the idea that the people in power are deeply concerned with giving offense to the people who are not in power. That is major progress in human relations. But of course, pendulum can shift too far. And I think that with Latinx, that particular term, it's been said that that is a term used almost only by academics and people in the media and has no purchase upon most Latino people living actual lives outside of academia and the media. I'm not Latino, and so I don't have a dog in that fight. But I think that that particular term is an example of how the ruling class is more aware and more sensitive now than you would ever have thought that it would have been as recently as, say, 20 years ago. So it's an interesting matter. And, you know, with the trans issue, that whole issue is now so complex and so sensitive and so transitional that I didn't include it in the book. I just wasn't quite sure myself where to grab on, so I left that for later. But those terms evolved too. I distinctly remember a trans person I knew 20 years ago using a term for trans people, which now is considered a slur. But I distinctly remember this person using it in affection, referring to themselves. These things change, and I'm sure that person no longer uses that term. So you have to keep on your toes.
One of the things I wanted to find out is how to refer to my nieces and nephews in a gender-neutral way. And I went looking and I found the word nibbling. And this word makes me so happy that we're making up words like nibblings for our siblings' children. Because isn't that a better word than nieces and nephews? So sometimes we just invent things that are fun and better as long as you take it with that lighthearted kind of thoughtful approach.
Without, I think that is very cute. Yeah, niece and nephew are a little clunky.
Yeah.
And nibbling, and you needed something gender neutral. I'll take that one.
I'll take it. I've got my nibblings now. I think language is fun, and this book is even funnier. It's called Nine Nasty Words, English in the Gutter, Then, Now, and Forever. And the author is a Columbia professor and linguist, John McWhorter. Thank you so much for spending time with us today. It's been a great deal of fun.
Thank you for having me.
John McWhorter speaking with Lori Walsh. As South Dakota high school seniors eagerly anticipate graduation, some took time to reflect and share with South Dakota Public Broadcasting how the COVID-19 pandemic impacted their last year of high school. Today, we hear from a Rapid City Stevens high school senior.
My name is Abby Scott, and I'm a senior at Stevens High School in Rapid City, South Dakota. So most kids start band in fifth grade, but my school actually started in sixth grade. And I actually went to Sturgis Middle School in seventh grade and didn't have the best band experience just because they didn't place as big an emphasis on the arts there. So I was really hesitant to do it my eighth grade year, but my mom said, just try it one more year. And if you don't like it, then that's okay. Then you can not play. So then I joined an eighth grade year and there's no way I could quit band. Like, I really like it. I love the environment because it's a whole different crowd of people and it allows me to meet a bunch of different people than I would in like classes or work or something like that. A drum major is basically the conductor of the marching band. So because I was drum major, I kind of interacted with a bunch of different sections. It's impacted a lot because not necessarily band events are canceled. They're just all virtual. So like I used to be used to my parents, like they'd always come to the concerts and record me and I could like watch it and stuff. But now we record during class and then I just watch the concert with them at home. So it's a really weird like experience, I guess. I think I've realized to just take events as you have them because nothing is guaranteed. So we don't know if certain events are going to happen or like even like get-togethers, how long you're going to be able to hang out. So I've just like realized that it's important to take what we have, because our marching season actually was cut short because almost the entire football team got COVID. The central football team, who we were supposed to play, so we weren't able to have our last game. And so like it made me realize that the game before that was our last game. Yeah, I realized it's just like more important, I guess, to live in the moment, because I don't know how many more moments I'm gonna have, I guess, because of cancellations or virtual or that kind of stuff. So I just kind of, whatever I do have in person, I don't take it for granted, I guess.
Abigail Scott is from Rapid City Stevens High School, and she's reflecting on her final year of school and how the coronavirus affected it. Up next, as the South Dakota Symphony Orchestra celebrates 100 years, we'll take time to consider how an orchestra can change a community. You're in the moment on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
This week on Science Friday, we solve a burning issue in science: why the big nuts rise to the top in the nut mix.
We've known about this for years, but how does it really happen? That's the key question here.
Plus, the secrets of NFTs and why artists are flocking to them.
The people involved, the passion, it's a totally different experience.
All on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This afternoon, beginning at 1 Central, Noon Mountain on SDPB Radio.
Program funding is provided by Denny Menholt Auto Group, Rapid City. During this time, we are here and ready to serve you, still providing the same quality service you've come to expect. Doing our part to keep you safe at Denny Menholt Auto Group, Rapid City.
When Jen and Ty Moes relocated to Webster, South Dakota 15 years ago, they cut the cord, and Jen says the programming is very meaningful to their family.
We're not paying anything for the antenna, but it's worth enough to me that I want to make a monthly donation to make sure that we've got it in our home and that we're supporting it. We're very proud to partner with South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Become a sustaining member of SDPB at sdpb.org/donate.
Program funding by Bangs McCullen Law Firm. From humble beginnings in the Dakota Territory over 130 years ago, now a full-service firm with offices in Sioux Falls and Rapid City. There for you then, here for you now. BangsMcCullen.com.
Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Kara Hetland. Grammy Award-winning classical pianist Emmanuel Ax was in residence with the South Dakota Symphony Orchestra in Sioux Falls last month. His residency included concerts at local schools, hospitals, and community centers. The week culminated with Ax joining the symphony in a performance that kicked off their centennial season. During Ax's residency, he sat down with conductor Delta David Geyer to talk about the importance of symphonies within communities.
There's nothing like having your own group in your own city and your own area. You know, I know that especially during the pandemic, we both know that everything has been available. You know, it's, you can sit in your home and you can listen to whatever orchestra you want, whether it's from Vienna or Japan or anything. But that's not the same.
Can't be in person, can't be live.
First of all, not in person, but also not having, it's not your city, it's not your group. And I think there's a tremendous value to that. It's interesting, in a country like Germany, where of course they value music very highly, but there's an area around Cologne where there are many little towns, and they each have a symphony orchestra. They each want their own, you know. So they, I think there are about 35 or 40 orchestras within 100 miles of Cologne.
Wow.
It's crazy, but it's not because they necessarily think that their orchestra is going to be far better than all the others,
right,
but they want their group. It's their town, and they want their group. And from what I can see, you get wonderful support here.
Absolutely, though, and this is, I mean, this is kind of unique. As you know, I lived in New York for so many years, and you could say that, you know, there are a lot of orchestras around New York City too.
Like
every city up the Metro North line in Connecticut has one.
Yeah, in a way.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
But here, it's very, Sioux Falls is quite isolated. You know, it's 4 hours to Minneapolis. 3 hours to Omaha, 5 hours to Kansas City. Like, it's isolated.
Yes.
So
yes.
I think what I've experienced here is that that ups the value.
Sure.
Of having the orchestra here.
And of course, also, you're the South Dakota Symphony Orchestra.
Right.
So you deal with a lot of people, not just in this city.
Right.
And I know you've been doing streaming with this wonderful station.
Yes.
And that's mm-hmm. been a great thing for the whole state, I'm sure.
Yeah. I mean, we try to get out and about as much as we can. The funding is always a challenge for touring, quite expensive,
sure.
as you know.
Sure.
You know, but we have
so many people to get around, of course.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, this orchestra turns 100 next year.
It's amazing. You know? That actually is amazing.
So the state wasn't even 30 years old, and the whole entire state,
how
and they found. Yeah. So you've got these Norwegian Lutherans.
Yes.
That come out,
yes.
and the music, of course, is so much part of their culture.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
you know is really important. So you know we've structured the next season around you know different historical moments of both the SDSO and the state. So of
yeah.
course, in the first concert, we're going to play Grieg. You know, so
fabulous.
because it's part of who they are.
But we generally, I think all over the country, we don't have the understanding, or we don't think about the fact that music has been part of our culture forever and ever.
Mm-hmm.
All kinds of music.
Right.
But even our kind of music, Western music, you
mm-hmm.
know, Western symphonic music, the New York Philharmonic and the Vienna Philharmonic started the same year,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Which is crazy in a way.
Right. Yes.
But the Cincinnati Symphony is over 100 years old.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it has, I would like to think, has been part of general culture in the U.S. for a very long time.
That's right.
And,
that's right. Yeah, and yeah. an important part, the I see less of that idea, that European idea of the symphony orchestra being a locus of mm. musical activity. Now we're trying
yeah.
to actually make it more so by our yeah. connections with schools and universities and
yes.
you know the whole
yes.
the whole range of educational
yes. Yes.
Activity so that people come to see the value of what the orchestra yeah. brings to the community.
Well, and just the pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
I think there is a lot of pleasure in going to symphony concerts.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of pleasure in so many American art movements that I don't even know about
mm-hmm.
and I'm beginning to discover. You know, and the more we can connect, the more we can do things together and find ways to connect and find people, talented people who will be able to connect us, I think the better off we are. I have a very close friend, you know, we've been playing together for 47 years, Yo-Yo Ma. And Yo-Yo is someone who has become comfortable in every possible way of making music.
Mm-hmm.
He plays Bach suites on his own. He plays Dvorak cello concerto with the orchestras. He plays with Kalahari Bushmen.
Mm-hmm.
He's done recordings with Stefan Grappelli, jazz records.
Mm-hmm.
He's done an Ennio Morricone disc.
Mm-hmm.
Movie music, you know,
yep.
he's comfortable with John Williams. He's been able to do all of this because he's interested in everything.
Yes.
And I think if we keep going that way, if we can just find a few more yo-yos in the
yes.
world,
right.
I think we'll be able to connect Beethoven and Dvorak and the Kalahari Bushmen and Paul Simon.
Yes.
And everything else into one great, glorious experience of music.
That's beautiful.
The South Dakota Symphony Orchestra Centennial Season will showcase local artists and sounds alongside world premiere events and the Lakota Music Project. Find more online at sdsymphony.org. Gayville Vollenhall in southeastern South Dakota is celebrating 20 years of live shows this Sunday afternoon. It also marks the first show in quite some time, with COVID-19 shutting down the venue for over a year. The Public Domain Tune Band has been scheduled for Gayville Hall's 20th anniversary show. Former SDPB's Morning Classics host and Public Domain Tune Band fiddler Owen DeYoung visited with In the Moment producer Steve Zwemke yesterday. He described the booking as a real honor.
It really is. We've known Judy and Doug Sharples a long time, the owners of Gayville Hall. I think we met them back in the 70s. And we were on the second show. I looked it up. The first show was a saxophone player. That was, I think, back in the early 80s.
Well, Doug and Judy, have they been the organizers of every show over the 20 years? I know there's been more than 350 shows at Gayville Hall. Has it been Doug and Judy organizing all of those?
It has been. They bought the building. This old building used to be called the Bagstead Mercantile Building, and it was a number of other things in between. When I first came to this area, that building was the food store in Gayville, and I know there was a beauty shop in there. And when that building went on auction, I guess Doug once told me he cast the first bid and ended up buying the store. So and that's, you know, definitely been since the 1980s.
Right.
So lots of shows.
For those who haven't been to a show at Gayville Hall, what can you tell us about this as a music venue?
Well, it's pretty cool that it's located where it is in this little town of Gayville between Yankton and Vermilion. There's really nothing else like it that I know of anyway. Like I say, it used to be the food store. Doug and Judy bought it. They built a little stage in there, and it's a unique venue because there's no alcohol. Nobody smokes, of course, in there. So it's kind of nice for us as musicians to have a venue like that where we play for a couple of hours and people just sit and listen, and then we're done, you know.
Yeah.
Not too many other places like that.
Is Gayville Hall constructed for certain types? Well, I guess it wasn't constructed for music, but are certain types of music better in there? Would a string band, say, sound better than like a fully amped rock band?
Well, I think probably so. It's hard for me to really say, but it's a small enough venue that you wouldn't want to get too loud in there because it would be overpowering. I mean, the first row of seats is just right up to the, there isn't more than 3 feet probably between the front of the stage and the first row of seats. So, you know, you couldn't get too loud of a group in there without making everybody pretty uncomfortable, I think.
Once again, we're visiting with Owen DeYoung, former host of Morning Classics here on SDPB, but also a longtime member of the Public Domain Tune Band, along with Larry Rohr, CJ Coker, and of course, Nick Schwabach, and they perform Sunday for the 20th anniversary of Gayville Hall. Owen, do you have any idea of how many shows you personally have played at Gayville Hall?
That's a good question. I don't know. I think I've probably been on most of them if you were to add them all up, but I couldn't say. You said there was, what, 300-some shows there?
Yeah, more than 350, and a lot of those were collaborative with a lot of different artists involved.
That's right. There have been some pretty good shows in there. I know public radio listeners will remember Robin and Linda Williams from Prairie Home Companion. They've performed there.
Wow.
And of course, I imagine I've been on more than over half of the shows that have been put on there with different groups, mostly Nick and me, but
and some of those,
I know it's been a lot.
Yeah, and some of those have been theme nights too, like a celebration of Johnny Cash. And I know there have been many, many other theme nights. Are there any that you remember in particular?
Well, we used to do a lot of those shows, like you said, the Johnny Cash show, where we played all Johnny Cash tunes. There was a Hank Williams show where we did all the music was music by Hank Williams. And there's been different theme shows. There was a show we did one time that was all religious music, you know, like church music. John and Susan McNeil, they were originally involved in all of those shows. They haven't performed there in some time. I don't know that they'll be there on Sunday. By the way, there are no more tickets available for Sunday. So if anybody's listening, they've got four shows coming up, though. There's two coming up in June and two more in July.
Well, Gayville Hall is not unlike other venues over the past year that COVID-19 has affected Gayville Hall. And is this the first show coming back now since COVID?
It is.
Wow.
It's been a year a year since we've played there. And, you know, it's pretty tough. It's not just for Gayville Hall, but for all venues
and all musicians.
And all musicians,
yeah.
Like me, I just haven't had the opportunity to play. So we'll see how rusty we are.
Well, speaking of yourself, is this your first time playing in a year plus?
Yeah, we played an outdoor two outdoor concerts this past summer, but they were booked before the COVID, or one of them was. The other was just for some friends out in somebody's yard. But a year. We play regularly on Friday nights at Carrie's in downtown Vermilion, and that's been over a year now. We were hoping to maybe start up on Friday, which today, I guess, as this program airs on Friday, we would have started today, but looks like rain, and I guess we're not up for playing indoors yet at Carrie's, which is too bad, but that'll all happen in its own time.
Hopefully it's close enough. Owen, it's great to see the Public Domain Tune Band together for this special event at Gayville Hall 20th Anniversary Show. And again, it's Sunday, and the start time is when?
2:00. Okay. Like I say, there's no more tickets available, but it's sold out. They're going to have a limited audience there.
Right.
Because of the social distancing there. They are trying to keep things safe, and I imagine that'll be true for the upcoming concerts in June and July also. So if somebody would be interested in attending one of those, it might be good to call Judy soon.
Well, Owen, thanks for this, and congratulations on making it back to the Gayville Hall after this hiatus we've all been in, and we look forward to the show.
Well, thanks, Steve. It's been great talking to you, and say hi to all of my friends there at SDPB.